Hello, this is Dan Le Batard, and today on this South Beach session, we talked to a guy who was a bit of a rudder on comedy for about a 10 or 15 year period where he was influencing, putting his imprint on everything from The Office to Parks and Rec, which he created. We ask you, if you love this show, to check out an article he decided to write. This is a multi-million dollar talent as a showrunner in Hollywood, creating television that's new and improved, and people were fighting over him recently because he's a creative television mind. If you want to read what I believe and what the crew believes to be the best thing written about our show in terms of getting it, this guy is the one who wrote it, and he is a brilliant comedic mind. He knows how to write for television. He knows how to create for television. So Mike Schur, who created Parks and Rec and The Office and Brooklyn, it's Brooklyn Nine-Nine, right, Mike?
Yeah, Brooklyn Nine-Nine. On top of that, he was a writer for Saturday Night Live, wrote Weekend Update, which is the benchmark of that series.
And so he is behind the scenes and now coming out a little bit more in front of the lights. And before we get to our conversation with him, because we want to talk to smart people, funny people about things outside of sport, tell the people about what's going on with our sponsors and how they support the people who support us, Mike.
Well, a lot of exciting things happening with Le Batard and Friends. Remember, you can subscribe to a Le Batard and Friends channel feed, and that entire feed, as well as the entire network, is brought to you by Tissot, the official watch of the NBA. Each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. The Tissot Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. While the Tissot PR100 family of watches brings together sporty and feminine details for a collection that is bold, romantic, and ideal for the modern woman. To shop Tissot, please go to us.tissotshop.com, and it's available at select watch and jewelry stores nationwide. By the way, that article that Mike Schur wrote on our show, it appeared in Slate. So just Google Slate, Le Batard, Mike Schur, and you'll find it. We'll get into this episode with Mike Schur in just a moment. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter. Oh, man. Hiring is challenging, but not anymore, because there's one place where you can go where it is made simple, fast, and easy, and smart. A place where growing businesses can connect qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/beach. Dan, I'm always telling you about ZipRecruiter and their powerful matching technology as they scan thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply for your job. And as applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidate so you never miss a great match. That's why I want you to listen to me right now as I tell you to try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. It's really important that you put that web handle in there. It's how we get credit. ZipRecruiter.com/beach to try it for free. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire.
So this guy is one of the smartest writers anywhere in Hollywood and in television. He really did shape a generation, an era, helped shape a generation, a time in comedy. Let's talk to Mike Schur. This guy came into our lives about a year ago, and he came and wrote an incredibly glowing article, and you could check it out, slate.com. It's still something that is easy to find, because it was moving to me that this guy, in general, just as a person or a reporter, cared enough to come and be in our environment and write a nice thing about our show that seemed to get our show. And then at some point during that, Mike Ryan says to me, yeah, that's the guy who kind of wrote The Office and Parks and Rec. And I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, shit. What happened there? Why would that person waste his time? No, it gets worse. Wait a minute. It gets worse. So now recently, as Stugatz has tried to get you to ghostwrite his book because he doesn't want to do any of the work, I'm learning that you've got these giant projects, and then I see Daily Variety report that you've got something for $25 million a year. You're like a wildly successful showrunner. I didn't know anything about you that way. I just thought you were some dope in the back of the room writing an article about us nobody would read.
Well, first of all, that's what I was and am. And the fact that I have other projects going on, or that I just signed a new deal, which I did at Universal, doesn't have anything to do with my love of your show and your work, or the fact that I was just at that time a dope in the back of the room writing an article about you. That's what I wanted to be. That was the whole point. Like, I came across your show completely accidentally, because I knew who you were and I knew that you had a podcast, but then, I don't know, it hit one of those like Malcolm Gladwell tipping points where like enough people told me that I should listen to the show. And I just started listening to it as I drove around L.A., and it became all I listened to. And it kind of still is all I listen to. I have an 11-year-old son, and he does an imitation of your dad saying Stugatz from the rejoins. He just walks around the house going, Stugatz! Because it's always playing in my car. So when I got in touch with you and asked to write about your show, it was just pure fandom, which is how it should be. Like, that's the best thing about being a writer, I think, is when you get to just write about stuff you like. And I have this weird accidental side career as a sports reporter. Not really, but kind of. I've written for a couple things for Slate about sports. And I just called their editor, Josh Levin, and said, can I go fly to Miami and write about these guys? Because it just was something I liked, and isn't that the whole point? I mean, that's the whole point of when I was talking to you guys, that was really the sense I got, is that you guys do what you think is fun. And that was, for my side, that was literally what I did. I just did it because I thought it sounded fun.
Well, but beyond that, though, one of the things that I've found interesting about your career and your journey, because I'd like to cover how it is that you got to here with you, is that you were counterculture blogger guy just in his spare time mocking mainstream sports journalism. You were doing this as Ken Tremendous with Fire Joe Morgan. You were at the cutting edge of, you know, sports writing snark, and you were doing this from what vantage point? Where were you in your career? How far were you from The Office and Parks and Rec?
It started when I was at SNL. I worked at SNL 98 to 04. So the Fire Joe Morgan started there, and it was just me and a couple of my friends who were also professional writers. My friend Alan Yang, who I think at the time was writing for South Park. My friend Dave King was writing for like Last Call with Carson Daly. And we and a couple other guys, and we just had this email chain where we would just write emails to each other complaining about stuff that Tim McCarver said or whoever. And finally, it was like, you know, if we just started a blog, we could just like have one central location where we could just write down all the crazy stuff we hear that's moronic. So that's how it started. I moved out to LA and started writing on The Office while I was doing Fire Joe Morgan. Like, that was a complete, that overlapped in that period of time. So I had part of the reason we were anonymous and chose like internet names is because I felt a little bad. We were pretty cruel. We were pretty mean to people. And so I was like, I don't want what we write about sports journalism to blow back on like on The Office or on SNL or anything like that. So we did it anonymously. And then after a while, we all felt guilty because it felt like the accused had a right to face their accuser. So we sort of came out and said, like, here's who we really are. And immediately, by that point, I had played the character Moe's on The Office a few times, who was like this sort of ghoulish, neck-bearded, like beet-farming weirdo. And there was an article in Deadspin that said, one of our favorite sports bloggers is Moe's. It was a picture of me. And it was like, yeah, I don't know what to tell you, man. Those are my two careers. I write for The Office and occasionally appear on it, and also I make fun of Mike Francesa and Tim McCarver on this weird blog that very few people read.
Well, help me understand something, though, because when I discovered Fire Joe Morgan, I'm like, oh, these guys are edgy, without knowing anything about you guys. I'm just like, oh, they're edgy and they seem to be a lot smarter than the people that they're mocking. And so I'm reading this without thinking that these are professional writers. I just think it's actually part of the reason that I gave up my Hall of Fame vote, because I saw that there were people on the internet, as I'm discovering the internet, who are smarter about baseball than I was and were teaching me things. I feel like if you had continued down that path, you'd kind of want to have the career we've had over here, where you could have just stayed in sports making fun of everybody from that position.
Yeah, I you're not wrong. Like, that might be part of the reason that I felt a sort of kinship with you and your show, is because there is a weird sliding doors thing where if I had cared about it, the subject of sports journalism a tiny bit more, I might have just broken in that direction. But we gave it up for two reasons. We gave it up first because I was starting Parks and Recreation, and I felt pretty strongly that it was irresponsible of me to run a TV show. Like, I didn't run The Office. I didn't create The Office. You know, I worked there, but that wasn't my baby. And now I was going to have my shot at doing my own show. And I felt like it was kind of irresponsible, knowing how much time we would take to like cut and paste an entire Joe Morgan ESPN chat into a blog page and go point by point and like research everything and make fun of it and whatever. It took hours. I mean, it was insane. It really was an insane quixotic quest that we were on. So I gave it up partially just out of professional reasons, but we also gave it up a little bit because it felt like the world had caught up. Like when we started it, you know, we were far from the first people. There were, you know, Jonah Carey and you know, people like that. Moneyball hadn't even come out yet, I think, when we started. Or maybe it just come out.
Well, see, that right there was the area where we intersected. Because I remember talking to Michael Lewis a bunch on the radio about Moneyball as it's coming out. And it's about the same time that I discovered your work without having any idea who you were.
Yeah, that was the era, right? It was like for the first time, there had been people, Bill James had been writing for years, but for the first time, that kind of analysis and those new metrics were crossing over. And we used to say as a joke, the Fire Joe Morgan guys would say, like, we'll stop doing this when you're watching a baseball game and instead of batting average, you know, home runs and RBIs, you see like OPS and, you know, WAR and fielding runs above average or something. And it was at the time it was a joke, and now it actually happens. Now those are the stats that that ESPN and other places just use. So we gave it up partially for professional reasons, but also we just felt like we were saying the same things over and over again, and the world had kind of caught up a little bit and had started to see the light and weren't. There were fewer and fewer old crusty dinosaurs who were writing about how, you know, if you want to know who a champion is, you look in his eyes or whatever. All the Stugatz arguments.
Yeah, but you see, but our every evolution and permutation comes from there, though. You realize you could have kept growing that out, that you could have, that wouldn't have been the only place, because all we do around here is make fun of sports media. The Daily Show, all it was doing was making fun of media from within media, right? That was smart television, and so that's all that we've been doing around here. You could have done the same thing. I feel like you could have done Parks and Rec for sports, that you could have done The Office for sports. You could have done Brooklyn Nine-Nine for sports. You could be running all of ESPN right now if you'd taken a different path.
Well, I've heard you say a lot that you wish that ESPN, for example, you say this on your show all the time, that you wish that people were having more fun, and that this is sort of the essence of your work at some level, right, is you wish it weren't taken so, the sports weren't taken so seriously all the time. And I do think it's possible, but the problem is that, like, you're walking a fine line. You and people like you are walking this fine line where, as you said to me when I wrote that piece on you, you're attacking the establishment from inside the establishment. And that means that, like, you're right on a knife's edge all the time of tipping over into either being the establishment or offending the establishment so much that, say, you throw up a bunch of billboards saying goodbye to LeBron James and you end up getting suspended. And so it's not that you can't do that. It's just a kind of life that I don't think I cared enough about that subject matter. I was doing it as a fan and as a sort of casual observer of the way that media talks about sports, but it didn't like burn in my soul as like, this is what I want my life's work to be. So, you know, ultimately I find it more fun to write long form narrative television. And so I sort of broke in this direction. It also happens to pay a lot of money. This is what I love. And so that hobby, that other thing was a hobby. And I think for you, I think I would say the inverse is true, right? Like, this is what your passion is. Your passion is making fun of this stuff from the inside. And other things in your life might be hobbies. And so it's not that you can't imagine doing something else with your life. It's just that this is the thing that you find the most fun, I would guess.
Yes, for me it is, but I don't know how much fun it was to write on SNL. I don't know how much fun it was to write on The Office. I don't know. It sounds to me, Parks and Rec would be overwhelming to me. It would be not fun, fulfilling maybe, but not necessarily fun because of how hard it would be to run an entire show like that.
Oh, it's a tremendous amount of fun, I would say. That show in particular, it had a crazy, weird journey. We were always almost getting canceled. A bunch of crazy things happened that were behind the scenes that were just in terms of like the machinations of networks and studios and stuff. It's not super interesting to talk about, but Amy Poehler and I were friends from SNL and we built that thing together. And Rashida Jones and I have been friends since college. We met like the second day of college in 1993. So I was doing a show about a subject I deeply cared about with very close friends. And we had this feeling of like every week it was like we have to do the very, very best show we can possibly do, because if we don't, the show might get canceled. And it was taxing and exhausting. You know, it was like emotionally draining. But when we got through that period and we came out the other side and people started to like it and it got recognition for various things, we felt this incredible sense of accomplishment and of love and passion for, I mean, honestly, that job is as good as it gets out here because I loved what I was doing. I was doing it with my friends. It mattered to me. It ended up mattering to some other people. Like, I know what you mean. Like, it is scary. And when you're 33 or whatever I was, and you are put in charge of $150 million a year enterprise that, you know, employs 200 people and stuff, like, it can, the thought of, I mean, I had a lot of sleepless nights. This is another thing, by the way, that I think you and I have in common, that when you were talking about the early days of your show, when it wasn't working and you guys hadn't figured out the rhythms and everything else, that you would just like stay up all night and like ride your bike around Miami and just lose your mind. Like, I had the TV equivalent of that a lot. Like, I would lie in bed at night and think, I can't believe I'm going to be the idiot who ruins Amy Poehler's career. Like, that was a thought I had all the time. Cause she was at the time, if you remember, she'd been on SNL, had this crazy run. She was, you know, she's one of the greatest to ever do it. And she had ended her career there 9 months pregnant, playing Sarah Palin on Weekend Update and rapping at Sarah Palin in one of the most popular sketches of like the last 5 years. And then she came, then she had her baby and she started Parks and Rec and the show got off to a kind of a rocky start. And I literally would lie awake at night and think, I'm going to be the asshole who ruins her career. Like, her career's been great until now. Everybody loves her. She's like America's sweetheart. And when people look back at her career, what they're going to say is she was doing really great until she teamed up with Mike. And that thought kept me awake.
You do realize, right, that this was a question about how much fun that wasn't. And you said, no, it was the most fun I've ever had. And now it's all pain and suffering. And I was going to ruin my friend's entire career. Like, nothing you're describing sounds like fun, except like, hey, people really liked the shit when we were done with it.
But that was the beginning. That was the beginning. And so now think about it being that full thing. It's literally where you are right now. You started with that level of anxiety about your show, and then you came through the other side, and now you're surrounded by people you love doing exactly what you want to do, exactly the way you want to do it. That's what we had too. Like, by the time we got through that bumpy period, it became this incredible thing where, like, look, I remember saying early in an interview, like season two or something, I was doing an interview and I said, look, the thing about this show, it to me is in 10 years, no one will be able to believe that all of these people were in the same cast. And it's now 10 years. This month is 10 years to the month of when the pilot aired. And no one can believe that.
How did you know? How could you have known?
I just did. It was you just watched them every day. You went to table reads and you wrote scripts and you would look around like no one knew who Nick Offerman was. No one knew who Chris Pratt was. No one knew who Aziz was. No, I mean, people knew Amy and they knew Rashida a little bit.
But you guys all knew in the room, oh, we're better at this than most of the people doing this. Everyone there knew it.
I knew that the cast was the best cast, like comedy cast, maybe ever. I really felt that way very early on. I just was like, you would look around the room and think every time one of these people opens his or her mouth, it's amazing. And I just had this really strong feeling. Greg Daniels, who created it with me, used to say very frequently, the thing that saved the show was the cast was great before the show got great. And he was right. It was like the cast was just so talented and so charismatic. In the, you know, 6 or 8 episodes it took us to really figure out what the hell we were doing, the cast was just so good. They just made everything work. And now it's like Chris Pratt's arguably the biggest movie star in America. He's got 2 enormous franchises and Aziz sells out Madison Square Garden. And, you know, Nick Offerman is like, can't walk down the street. And Adam Scott has done a million things. Like the entire cast has done exactly what it felt like they were going to do, which is go on to be really famous and successful and great, have great careers. So I know that it doesn't sound fun when I say that I lay awake at night, but I think anything that's truly great, any artistic endeavor that's truly great is going to have that as part of its story, that like you don't know whether it's going to work. And then what makes it so satisfying is that you come out the other side.
Is then that the most fun that you've had in an atmosphere? Like, I imagine those Saturday Night Live after parties were drug fueled. You've got The Office is, you know, a magical hit in this country. Like, where was the most fun actually being had in real time?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard not to say SNL because the thing about SNL is like everyone is 24 and it's everybody's first job and you kind of can't believe it. I mean, I was there for the 25th anniversary show, which was in 2000, either 99 or whatever. And like every single person came back, every single living cast member came back. And then like, you know, Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and Whoopi Goldberg. And like, it just, anyone in comedy was like in the same room at the same time. And I was at the time, I was 24, I think. And I just was like, I can't believe this is happening. Like that every single person who's funny in America just is like, yeah, well, of course I'm going to come to that thing because that's how important that institution is. And then because everybody's young and it's everybody's first job and you're living in New York and it's like crazy, that show, SNL, has waves of self-esteem, and the internal mood matches the self-esteem that it is derived from the show being good. And so, you know, there it goes. It's like a sine wave. It goes up and down. And when in 2000, when Will Ferrell, 99-2000, Will Ferrell started playing George Bush and Daryl Hammond started playing Al Gore, and then the crazy 2000 election happened, and suddenly SNL mattered, like really mattered in a significant way. And the self-esteem from that. Like, it matters. And so it started to be really fun to be working there and to go to those parties afterwards. And Horatio Sands, there was always an after party from 1 to 4. Horatio Sands started an after party. They went from 4 to 6 in the morning, where we would just like shut down a bar and just stay there. And then you would walk outside at 6:30 in the morning on a Sunday, and it would be bright sun, and there'd be people like jogging on the street and going out to brunch and stuff. And you were just in the same clothes you were wearing the night before, just miserable, you know, smoke like stained and booze stained. And it was so fun. It was just like, what a time to be alive. Like, you're 25 years old and that's your life. So it's hard not to say SNL, but creatively, you're writing 3-minute sketches or 4-minute sketches every week. If you're lucky, one of them gets on the air and is like a middling success. So creatively speaking, Parks and Rec was probably the formative thing for me, that where, you know, when that show clicked on all cylinders, that's probably the most pride I think I had taken in anything.
What do you remember from that Saturday Night Live reunion show when all of comedy is gathered there, except Eddie Murphy didn't go to that one, did he? Did he go that
he
one?
He did not, no. Eddie Murphy didn't go because he was mad at David Spade, because David Spade did a Hollywood Minute joke in like 1994 or something, where he showed a picture of Eddie Murphy and he said, oh, look, a shooting star or a falling star or something. And Eddie Murphy, pretty rightfully,
yeah, like, I'm gonna say, like, I gotta side with Murphy on this one. You, Spade, I'm Eddie Murphy.
Oh,
come on, man.
100% you side with Eddie Murphy, especially because literally the only reason the show is still on the air is that Eddie Murphy saved it in 80-81. After Lorne Michaels left, Eddie Murphy was the only cast member who mattered on that show for like 2 years while they were trying to figure out what the hell it was. And so it was sort of a little bit like, come on, man. The whole thing about SNL is there's no sacred cows. SNL was forged in the Watergate era, and the idea was, and Lauren talks about this all the time, whoever's in power, it doesn't matter who it is, whoever's in power, you take a cynical stance against them, you assume they're full of shit, and you attack them. And that means you play both sides. If a Democrat's in office, you attack the Democrat. If a Republican's in office, you attack the Republican. That's how the show retains its credibility, is it doesn't seem like it's too skewed. And, you know, when Norm MacDonald was doing Update, he was an avowed Republican and told people on air to vote for Bob Dole. It was really, and it felt weird. It was like, not just because it's supposed to be countercultural, but because the show just kind of didn't do that. The show took the position that whoever's in power in any realm of society deserves scorn and derision, and they deserve to be taken down. But on the other hand, when it's one of your own, when it's Eddie Murphy or something, it's sort of like, well, what's the point of that? Like, why do that joke? Like, he's not the president. He's not a senator. He's like, why go after your own guy? And the only time I ever felt bad at that show, because I produced Weekend Update for 3 years, the only times I ever felt bad are when I felt like it wasn't a fair hit, that we did a joke where it was like, that person doesn't deserve that joke. That's the only time that show can really run afoul. And so, yeah, Spade went after Eddie Murphy, and he was the only real notable no-show, and I kind of am on his side.
And so, but what was that night like? What do you remember about just your interactions and just what your career might become from that point if you allowed yourself to dream while in that room?
Well, there were two things that happened within a year. There was the SNL 25th, and then there was the NBC 75th, which they did a three-hour live show in 8H in the SNL theater with, like, every old show, every ER and St. Elsewhere and Get Smart and, like, you know, the Sid Caesar show. Like, everyone from entertainment came back. That was a nightmare. I was like, by the way, I was one of the writers on the show. And so literally everyone from history, from NBC history is at that show. It's really crazy. Sid Caesar was there and Bob Newhart and everybody. And there was only one, there's literally one person who gave us trouble because it's a tiny studio. There's like three dressing rooms. There's no room. It's a tiny, tiny studio. And so everyone who came, we were told, like, look, you can't have a private dressing area, you can't have a private dressing room, whatever, we're just going to have to make do. Everyone across the board, these enormous stars of all these famous shows, every one of them was like, totally get it, no problem, don't worry about it, except for one. The only guy who gave us trouble was the guy who operates ALF. That guy was like the most demanding dude. He was like, I need my own dressing room, and the ALF puppet needs its own dressing room, and I need, like, just made like the craziest demands. It was amazing. It was literally like, you know, whoever, George Clooney is like, yeah, whatever you guys need. And Jay Leno is like, yeah, no problem. The one guy that gives us trouble is ALF. That's really what I remember from that one. The SNL one was absurd. I mean, I had been at the show for like a year, maybe a year and a half at that point. And it was just every single, like, Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin and Lorraine Newman and Garrett Morris, the entire original cast except for Belushi was back. Bill Murray's walking around. Paul Simon's walking around. Mick Jagger's walking around. Like, I got used to it very quickly. Like, it was shocking. And then you just get used to it because it's just where you work. And I remember my uncle, Jeff, came to the show, like, 2 years in, and we were at the after party, and he suddenly grabbed my arm, and he was like, don't move, don't look, but Dan Aykroyd is standing right behind you. And I was like, yeah, he's here every week. Like, Dan Aykroyd to me at that point was wallpaper, like, because it just becomes like that's, you're in this family where people are just all coming and hanging out. And so it ceases to be, you cease to be starstruck by it very quickly, which sounds jaded, but it's just sort of the truth, you know?
Was it hard to leave there, or were you at that point ready to go? Because the thing is a pressure fryer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I was there for 6.5 years, and I think that's about the right amount of time. Like, I basically spent my 20s there. And you can stay there, but you become a different version of an SNL writer. You become a sort of, you move to like Montclair, and you don't go out super late anymore, and you treat it more like a job. And I kind of never wanted to treat it like a job. I always felt like the fun of it was like an insane way to spend, you know, 26 or 30 weeks a year. It was time. It's a young person's game, and to me at least. And my then girlfriend, now wife, had moved out to LA, and she was writing out here, and it just felt like that's the natural move. So it was hard to leave because, like, it's an amazing job. You get to live in Manhattan if you want to, and every time you tell someone what you do for a living, they're interested in you, and it was incredible. But it also just felt like at a certain point, I was sick of writing in 4-minute chunks, and it just seemed like there was more interesting stuff to do. So it was just, I think it was time.
So you go to Los Angeles, and I don't mean for you to have ego about this, but I'm guessing that pretty early on, you probably thought to yourself, oh, wait a minute, these people aren't actually more impressive or smarter than I am.
Well, it's complicated. I had to move because it was the end of the year and I decided to do it. And, you know, if my relationship was going to work, it required us to be living in the same city. We had been dating long distance for like a year and a half and it sucked. So I went on a bunch of interviews and I met with a bunch of people and I sat down. I had a meeting with Greg Daniels, who I didn't know. I knew his name, but I had never met him. And he was all I knew was he was adapting the British Office for American TV. And my opinion, which was most people's opinion, was what a terrible idea. That's never going to work. Like, it's too beautiful and pure and amazing, and it'll never work for an American audience. So I went into the meeting with an enormous amount of skepticism. And then we had like a 2.5-hour meeting. He had back trouble, and he actually at one point just lay down on the floor And he's an odd guy. He lay down on the floor in front of me, but we continued to talk about television. And at some point, it felt like I was his therapist because I was sitting in a chair and he was lying on the floor. But he just was talking about his theories about the show and about what was going to make it work. And I started to feel like, oh, this guy is a genius. Like, it's a word that gets thrown around too much, but I think it applies here. And I called my agent when I left the meeting and I said, I don't know if that show gets picked up, but if it gets picked up, I don't care how many episodes it is or what the circumstances are, I'm taking that job. And my agent said, why are you so sure you want to do that? And I said, 'cause that guy's going to teach me how to write. I literally said those words. So it got picked up for 6 episodes and I went to work for him and he taught me how to write. Like he's just a sort of scientist about the art of sitcom writing. And there were times when we would be at work. That first year, there were only 3 full-time writers. It was me, Mindy Kaling, and BJ Novak. And none of the 3 of us had ever written anything, really, before. He basically taught a class. Like, he taught like a graduate seminar in storytelling and TV writing. And there were times when he would be talking about stories where I would stop, like I was writing notes and trying to come up with pitches for the episode, and I would stop and I would just start taking notes of what he was saying like he was a professor. And I still have them. Like, I still have pads of paper with like just aphorisms and insights and kind of like structures and stuff written down that I like refer to sometimes because he's just that good. And like, he is the reason that that show became what it was. So I don't think I had a moment where I was like, oh, I'm really good at this. I'm better than other people are. I had a series of moments where I thought, this guy, Greg, is better at this than everybody. And if I just listen, if I shut up and listen to what he's saying, that will make me good at it. And that's what happened.
Oh, but it sounds like you got lucky, though, that you ran into somebody. The people I've talked to about this generally find Hollywood to be really dramatically unimpressive. But it sounds like you that you stumbled upon someone there that not everyone gets to stumble upon.
Oh, 100%. I just read this book called Success and Luck and the Myth of Meritocracy or something like that. It's by an economist who teaches it to Cornell, I think. Robert Frank is his name. And he basically talks about how people dramatically underestimate how much luck plays a role in their lives in every arena. And it starts with this anecdote where he had a heart attack and he was playing tennis and his friend called 911 and there happened to be 2 ambulances who responded to a car accident like 30 seconds away from where they were playing tennis. And because 2 ambulances showed up, one of them was able to break off, get to the guy, resuscitate him, and keep him alive. And he basically says, like, everything that happened after that moment in my life at some level is because of luck. Like, that was just blind luck. It had nothing to do with me. And it really resonated with me because I think all the time about the number of moments in my life that are purely attributable to luck. Like, and that's one of them. Like, I happened to be moving out here the same year that he happened to be developing that show, and I happened to have a meeting with him, and he happened to like me. And then that show happened to survive. That show almost got canceled 500 times, especially in the early going. And at some level, it's all luck. Like, I could have ended up in a completely different scenario if that show had gotten canceled or if I had taken a different job or if I had decided to stay at SNL one more year. A lot of Hollywood, like a lot of everything, is unimpressive, but some of it is really impressive. There are people out here who are brilliant and who will like blow you away with how their acumen and their abilities. And he's one of those guys. And I happen to fall into his universe. And that's what changed my life more than anything.
So as you're growing up watching television, the shows that you're watching, that you're loving are what? That are growing your love of television. What are those shows?
SNL was huge, and SNL and Monty Python were both really big for me. But then, like, actual narrative shows, like Cheers was my favorite show, kind of still is. The Golden Girls was huge for me. I loved that show. Like, I loved all that era of, like, NBC, Family Ties, 227. I really loved 227 because I was kind of in love with Jack A. Harry. That whole era, Night Court, like, all that. All of those like 80s, 90s NBC shows were huge for me. I was into The Simpsons a little bit, but then I was in college 93 to 97. So I missed like the really formative years of The Simpsons and Seinfeld and some of the shows that for people who are a little bit older or younger than me are sort of canonical. I was never really into those. So it was more the Cheers era, I think.
I'm wondering, though, you must get attracted to good writing on television. What are the shows that you look at and say top five for me in terms
of all time or right now?
Yeah, just the writing on shows. Just, well, you could pick five from whatever time period you like, but those shows you picked were smarter shows and the writing was very good, but the writing now, it seems to me, over the last 15 years to be stronger in television than it's ever been.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think most things in TV are stronger than they've ever been just because there's been this explosion of places that make TV. And so a bunch of ideas that could never have gotten made in the old system have gotten made. Like, starting with The Sopranos, all of the like great dramas of the last 20 years were shows that never would have worked on networks, ever. Like, The Sopranos, The Shield, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Justified, like there's all these dramas of the last 20 years that just could not have existed unless premium cable places and streamers and stuff like that had started making content. So there's an analogy to athletics, right? Like, remember when Steve Kerr, Charles Barkley was running his mouth about how, or someone, Scottie Pippen, about how, you know, the Warriors couldn't have beaten the whatever 89 Pistons or whatever, and they asked Steve Kerr about it, and his response was the best. He was like, yeah, that's the way sports works. Every year the athletes get a little worse. They get a little less athletic and a little worse and a little they get worse at basketball. That's how it works. Good job. And like that, I think that it's not entirely true. It's not directly analogous in writing or in TV, but like, it's not analogous. There is better production, there's a value, there's better writing, there's better acting. Like, every, if you look at any old show, you'll see something that is like a little, feels a little amateurish. Comedy doesn't age well, but even in drama, you'll just see stuff that, like, man, there's stuff that's recent that's better than this. And I think most of the shows I would cite as like all-time classics, even though it seems like recency bias, those are the shows. It's The Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, Justified, Breaking Bad. It's stuff like that that you just can't. I mean, Game of Thrones is the most entertaining show I've ever seen, I think. And it's also like really well written. Like, the dialogue is really good. The characters are really well drawn. The plotting is really good. Obviously the visual effects are like insane. They're going to spend $25 million or something on every episode this year. There just is more, people are better at this than they used to be. And that doesn't mean there weren't great shows. Like, I still think Mary Tyler Moore is one of the best shows of all time. It's not like that's not a good show anymore. It's just that now we know more. We just know more every year, and people get better and better, and they have the benefit of past stuff to base their current writing off of. So,
you didn't mention any modern comedies. You didn't mention, among all of those, Arrested Development comes to mind for me. But you weren't mentioning stuff like The Office and Parks and Rec, which, you know, belongs in that conversation.
Well, I'm not going to talk about my own shows.
Like, well, but comedy. How about your own region? Comedy, right? Shows,
well,
like,
yeah,
it.
Look, I have a little bit of a personal rule that I try not to praise or disparage people who are doing the same thing that I'm doing, like exactly the same thing. Arrested was a great show. But if I start praising comedies, then whatever I don't mention, it'll be, someone will hear it and be like, oh, I guess I didn't make the cut. And if I disparage things, then you're just disparaging things, and what the hell is the point of that? So I try not to publicly talk about too much about comedy, like, you know, just for that reason. It feels like it's a trap.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean to do that to you. No, and actually, you really saw through it, because I've cultivated my entire relationship with you to this point just so that I could get you in that particular trap. And, and I failed, and I'm ashamed of myself. So you go from all of these successes that you have as you're climbing up the ladder, and forgive me because I don't know the details of what I was reading in Daily Variety the other day, but it said you were getting $25 million a year for something that I didn't even understand after the success of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. This doesn't have anything to do with Abby's, the show you have premiering March 28th on NBC, right?
Well, it sort of does. First of all, I would say that number is a wild guess that was proffered by a journalist who was sort of making it up.
Love that number, though. And don't that's fine. Okay. You've denied it enough. I love that number. This guy that we're interviewing, the reason you should be listening to him is because he makes $25 million a season.
That's right. That's money. More money equals more value in terms of who you are as a person. We all know that. So there's two ways to go about being a writer. I mean, there's a million ways, but the two basic ways are, you can either be a sort of a free agent and just come up with ideas and sell them around to whoever wants to buy them, Or you can be on what's called an overall deal, which means like you're centered at a studio. You could be like a salaried employee of a studio, and then you create a bunch of stuff over the length of that deal, and you try to sell it either to the network that's connected to that studio, in this case NBC, or theoretically you can go out and sell it to other places. So that contract you read about, I signed a 5-year deal to continue working for Universal Television, which has been my home base for forever. So that's what you read about. It's a sort of like I'm a salaried employee of Comcast Universal and not just a guy who's wandering around town trying to get people to buy my
stuff. I'm hearing about a TV show called Abby's, Mike, and I got someone perfect for the role if you're interested.
Oh, do you?
I know someone who's perfect for the role. If indeed you are interested, and incidentally, since I'm on the phone with you, personal record book, I've left you a couple of messages about you writing that f***ing book and you haven't responded. And so I'm thinking like maybe 85-15 my way. I could be swayed 80-20, but right now I'm at 85-15. What do you think?
So 85-15 is both your starting point and the end of the negotiation. Is that the deal?
I could be swayed from 85-15 to 80-20. That depends on whether or not my wife stars in your new show, Abby.
I feel like I should set the record straight on what exactly happened.
Hold on a second. Let's get Stugatz out of here. Get out of here, Stugatz. Nobody invited you here. Nobody wanted you here. You just wanted to get near the microphone. Get out of here. Let me talk to Mike.
All right. I'm out of here. Mike, I just need an answer COB today, okay? COB for me is about an hour. Okay?
All right. Get out of here. All right. No, Mike, you got to tell. Oh, my God. The audience is going to love this. So, again, this dude comes into our lives, writes a way too flattering article about our entire environment, loves what we're doing around here, loves Stugatz, and then Stugatz, because he doesn't know what The Office is or Parks and Rec, at least I genuflected when I realized what was on your resume. Stugatz still doesn't know what these shows are, and Stugatz is wearing this guy out, asking you to do what?
So the first thing that happened was you guys had been doing the personal record book thing for a while on the show. So when I came, I think I asked him about it. And he was like, no, it's real. Like, we've got publishers, you know, who are interested and whatever. And Mike, I think, had at one point said that, like, there was a proposal being put together or whatever. So Stugatz talks to me about the book while I'm there. And I was like, it's a great idea. You can totally see it. You can totally imagine it, whatever. So maybe a week after I leave, I come back here and we exchange numbers. I see he's calling me on the phone and I pick it up and he goes, listen, I think the article had just come out maybe. So he says, it was so great. Great job. It was really flattering. I said, oh, sure. My pleasure. And he goes, listen, so about this book, he goes, just tell me what you think of it. Cause here's what I'm thinking it would be or whatever. And we started sort of bouncing ideas off each other. And I was like, here's what you should do. You should write something insane and then have like Mike or Billy or somebody like fact check it in real time. Like just write footnotes with all the stuff you're getting wrong. And, or you could get like a real sports writer to write a counter argument to every argument you make. And he was like, yeah, that's great. And he was like, so, what do you think? Like, I think we could really do this. Like, do you think you could write something up? And I was like, listen, man, I love you. I'm such a huge fan. You know that. I think this book could be really funny. I would love to like contribute a piece to it. Like, if you wanted me to write something for like a one piece or something, I would love to do that. I would be honored to do it. But I don't have the bandwidth to write it.
To
like,
do
I
it for
I can't
you.
Write.
You want me to do the job for you.
So I said, like, I don't quite
TikTok,
have that.
B.O.B., TikTok, 90-10 now. Every passing second, Mike, the percentages are going down and more in my favor. TikTok.
TikTok.
I basically just said, I don't quite have the ability to write the whole book. And he was like, I totally understand. I'll be in touch. And he hung up, and I have not talked to him since just right now as he yelled at me through your phone.
I have the ability to write the damn book. I mean, what are you, out of your mind? Like, let's go. I mean, now we're done 95.5 now. Let's go.
See you later. See you later, Mike. See you later, Stugatz. Mike, we appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me, bud. This was really fun.
Yeah, for us too. Our thanks to Mike Shore for not ruining a generation of comedy, even though it kept him up at night trying to be around all of those talented people. Speaking of talented people, Michael Lewis is as good an author as you will find anywhere in American literature these days. Not just the success of his projects, the way he could take complicated things and just make them really simple. We like to talk to smart people around here, so Michael Lewis will be here with us next week. Again, a reminder to rate, subscribe, and review. Check out the Lebatard and Friends Podcast Network. It has its own channel. You can subscribe to the channel and you can get everything that the menu of Lebatard and Friends offers. We will talk to Michael Lewis next week.